What's that eureka moment like?
You know, it's you would think.
Are there moments like that where you're just like, I know.
You would think that scientists would just have like a big, huge eureka moment. Those come really infrequently. It's more, and I think maybe the students expect those more often, but it's really small incremental steps.
Okay.
So we started the first Bubble Baby clinical trials in 1990. And it worked, but the cells didn't really engraft because we couldn't give the patients anything to clear their marrow first. And it took that long to actually really work.
Wow.
Until just like the last couple of years. And Don continued to work hard at it and refine the techniques. And yeah, I went off to St. Louis and then came back here 10 years ago. Yeah, the Midwest was not for me, but I did meet an awesome husband there. Hi, honey. So I came back to California when the Prop 71 passed, and this was becoming the place to be for stem cells. So it was time to come home.
So rather than the big eureka moment, we're looking at sort of like a series of incremental changes,
yeah,
and a lot of persistence,
yeah,
and sort of diligently keeping your...
Once in a while you get the eureka moment. So I had
right?
one back working with Don where we realized that we could insert the gene into the actual stem cell that made all of the cells in the blood system. And that was actually a moment when a blot came out and you saw that everything matched. And I still have that sheet, you know, that came out of the machine. Yeah, and I remember looking at it and just bursting into tears because it would work. So
that's
great.
So interesting. And it's just,
yeah,
this printout.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my goodness.
Just, yeah, it's the same as these and these. That means they're from the same stem cell. It could work.
You know, one of the things that interested me about having you on is that you're sort of a Renaissance man, right? You're sort of like a high school athlete and star. I think you were in a band in college, Mystic Wine. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. And then Visitor was the other band.
Okay. and then you continued to express yourself artistically. You wrote a children's book,
mm-hmm,
and sort of, you know, continued to, I think maybe express that urge to create and started a business, NutriShare.
Mm-hmm. Correct. That's a good summary. I think I was thinking on the way, on the drive over, I was thinking that I think one thing I kind of wanted to maybe say, or I say to myself, is that, you know, I really wasn't, I grew up very poor in Lodi,
mm-hmm,
and oldest of five, and it was just a struggle to financially, but
I'll bet.
It was a great childhood. And, but... So I always realized that really I wasn't really blessed with anything really special, but mm-hmm, what I was blessed with was a lot of being pretty good at a lot of things. So I think that's where my pride is, that at least I didn't get height or great looks or other skills, or I wasn't a great musician. I was good enough to play and to be paid through high school and college and after graduating being a pharmacist. But so anyway, in a nutshell, I was able to use, I think, a lot of the creative gifts, mm-hmm, I had from, I think, writing and creativity, art, and music in business, like as you say, in my business named NutriShare. And even the creation of that took out-of-the-box thinking.
Okay.
So, but... anyway, that's my quick thought, is that what I take for myself is, yeah, not gifted as I would have liked to have been. Like, I wouldn't mind just being really good at music, and, you know, making it big.
You tell me you wouldn't mind being a rock star.
Yeah, there you go. That would have been, you know, number one job.
And, yeah, yeah.
But aside from that, you know, there were a lot of other gifts that were just pretty good. And to be able to take advantage of those has been probably more advantageous to me in the long run. And this might be random, but so why did you start doing these podcasts?
Sure. Thanks for asking. There's sort of a confluence of events. I, you know, to be frank, I always kind of felt like I had the gift of gab.
Good.
And so I remember years ago, I was catching up with an old friend and, you know, they'd ask me, well, what are you doing now? I says, oh, well, you know, I'm in politics. And she says to me, well, I'm glad you found a useful outlet for all of that. You know, when I think of my fondest memories in my childhood, I was lucky enough to be raised by parents who just kind of spoke to their children. You know, my mom and dad were both newspaper folks. They both wrote for newspapers. So we were just kind of, before they split up and after they split up, we were just kind of always talking. What do you think about this? What do you think about this? What do you think about that? And mm-hmm. when I look back on my fondest memories on catching up with friends, you know, experiences is a big one, but also just like the experience of just chatting and connecting with people, right? Mm-hmm. Because I've had varied interests, both, you know, athletically, I'm around a lot of prize fighters.
Okay.
You know, like over Ultimate mm-hmm. Fitness, you know, I'm also around a lot of elected officials. Right. And I'm also, you know, I just find the variety of stories and people that I have been privileged to be around to be totally remarkable. And I also want to combine that notion with, you know, this theory that I have that I think entertainment is changing. You know, if you get a, you know, we couldn't do this on TV, just talk, mm-hmm. you know, if I clear my throat, I clear my throat. It's just sort of, it's what it is, you know? Mm-hmm. I feel like news and then broader human interest pieces are being crammed into these like 3-minute segments, mm-hmm, of course. You know, and you don't really get the time to fully appreciate the way that people's experiences influence and shape who they actually are, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that the best format for that is to just sort of chat. I can't tell you how many times I've been either at a, you know, at a diner or out with, you know, maybe having a conversation with previously a stranger and saying, man, I wish I could record this. I wish I could save this. This is an incredible story, you know? So, so that's part of what it is. Also, I think Sacramento, you know, it's really just a remarkable city.
One.
So just to be clear, they terminated you for not participating in their practice, which was later found illegal.
That's my position.
Well, you know, I had this question for you earlier, and I guess we're answering it now. What I planned on asking you was sort of, you know, with the saturation of graphic designers and photographers in the market, you know, and also the quick availability of, you know, template-based design apps mm-hmm. like Canva and stuff.
Mm-hmm. And Fiverr and smaller, cheaper.
Right, right. How do you continue to stay relevant? I mean, you've thrived, right? You've done work for some of the Sacramento's most prominent clients. How do you sort of set yourself apart in a saturated market like this?
It all comes back to that old cliche of it's not what you know, it's who you know, 100%. And becoming friends with the owners of these establishments. And they all know my sleep schedule and they have very similar sleep schedules. And so we always, yes, we either have meetings at 3 a.m. or at 1 p.m.
Yeah.
And it's been like this for the past, 10 years I've been doing this. But I can see, and this is a particular niche market that I just fell into that constantly needs designs and constantly needs, new events to think up. And, when I'm talking about the nightclub world and the sports bar world, I can see how for other designers, this can be difficult if they're just doing this from home, and doing just normal clients where you have to battle against these, overseas cheap templates, Fiverr and which undermines. But ultimately, I feel that I've had clients, and I encourage clients to go and try these. If you're even pondering it before going to me, just asking, go ahead and do it. Then I would go do it. And then see what you get back. And if it's awesome, cool. You just saved yourself some money. But ultimately, I'm ultimately guaranteed that you're going to come back with something that's garbage and I have to go and fix it, which has been the case. And, you know, they're not reachable and they're not in tune. I think that I'm with the market, that is. Like, I feel that my advantage to Sacramento market is that because I've been here since the wee dawn of every nightclub and bar. And so I've seen what works and I've seen what kind of a demographic would appeal to, so I can accommodate those type of branding and looks and parties that we throw, themed parties that would be good for your crowd. So I think that weighs into all of that as well.
So your value proposition is precisely that you are local.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
At one point you served as an undercover narcotics officer.
Yes.
Can you talk to us a little bit about that experience? What's that like? What's going undercover like? You hear about it a lot, but I guess what's the process of it like? Do you ever worry about being spotted in your community? I mean,
you did back then. And what's interesting, there's a series on right now on rock cocaine and the gangs in LA.
Okay.
That was it back in 1988. It was the Bloods and Crips, a lot of crack cocaine being sold on Sacramento streets. There's a lot of drive-by shootings. And what was different, these drug dealers would just sell anywhere on a street corner to anybody. So Sheriff Glenn Craig got five of us together. It was called the Street Team, Undercover Narcotics Team. There were four guys and one woman, and our job was to go out and buy drugs every night in Sacramento County. So we'd do multiple buys, driving up in a car, riding up on a bike, walking up, drinking a beer, just to get out of character. So we just do it. So it was 5 years, and it was fun. It was scary, and you had an instant impact on the neighborhoods, and the fact that you were putting bad guys away right away and getting them out of the neighborhoods.
Wow. You were directly exposed to just how many bad guys there can be out in any given neighborhood, or just how bad people can be. Do you feel like sometimes that goes underappreciated when you know, nowadays as a legislator, you see a lot of, potential legislation that's soft on crime sometimes, right? And you bring a law enforcement perspective. Do you feel like that colors your view?
Yeah, it does. And disappointing on some of the laws that have been passed. And I'll tell you what, when we're out there doing the undercover drug buys, people would come up and, you know, stolen meat from the grocery store, TVs, VCRs, radios. One time a lady said, here's my 12-year-old daughter. You can have sex with her for a quarter gram of crack cocaine.
Oh, my goodness.
So when you think about it, nothing good happens because of drugs. Think about people who are doing burglaries, home burglaries, vehicle burglaries, to feed a drug habit. You have robberies, armed robberies or strong-arm robberies. A lot of bad things happen because of drugs, and people don't really think about that. And, you know, just think about even alcoholism. It is tough to quit being an alcoholic, and sometimes you may never stop it, but it may take three or four times of treatment to do that. The same thing with drugs. On substance abuse, it has destroyed a lot of people, and pretty much everyone knows someone that has suffered from substance abuse. So it's, you see people at their worst, and it's just tragic, the lives that have been lost and ruined because of substance abuse.
Absolutely. You know, this is kind of off the cuff, but you know, we talk a little bit about substance abuse. I feel like perhaps in the last couple of decades, crack cocaine was a huge epidemic, and now we're moving towards opiates. Is the addiction to opiates kind of have the same criminological profile as the addiction to crack cocaine? I'm sorry, that's kind of out of left field question.
That's okay. It's changing. Back then, there was a opioid epidemic. People were shooting up heroin, and that we had AIDS back then. It was at the forefront, a lot going on, and folks had gotten away from it. But because of the pills, the Oxycontin, pills are very expensive. So people get addicted to pills, get hooked on it, and eventually they go to using heroin because heroin is much cheaper. And who would ever inject a drug in their body? People are doing that now, and it's unbelievable, and it's just so hard, like I said, to get off of drugs. And a lot of folks don't realize people are very dismissive, and I think in some ways society's become more permissive about drug use. But they don't realize the drug abuse that happens. Right. And I think one reason it's changed is because it's hit some middle class folks and people that have money. So now a lot more attention's been focused on, where before it was just poor people and people of color. And, you know, not as much attention was focused on it.
Right. I mean, I was going to ask you, you know, frankly, the crack cocaine epidemic was sort of couched as this, as like a crime epidemic as well, right? And now the opioid epidemic is being couched as a public health issue. And so, right. And I think for a lot of people, folks are like, well, that's rich. Now that it's white people with money, it's a health thing,
right? And there's some truth to that. But one thing about the crack epidemic, what a lot of people don't know is that was one drug. People stood in front of houses on street corners; they would sell to anybody. Mm-hmm. So you had drive-by shootings, neighborhoods being taken over and ruined, and that was really the big issue. You know, as far as drugs being sold out in the open, that was more than any other drug.
Got it.
Versus heroin or methamphetamine. That was, to me, the big difference, where the enforcement had to crack down on that because it really ruined a lot of neighborhoods.
I'm the type of guy, for myself, if I want to do something, I want to be technical, I want to be proper, I want to know what I'm doing. You know, the idea of just kind of flinging my arms in space and hoping I look good doing it is like really... you know, intimidating for me. You know, I want to at least have some theoretical framework for the aesthetics of movement that I can build from in order to be comfortable dancing. You know, for the longest time, I was just like kind of scared of it because everyone around my family just kind of could naturally do it. And I was like, will somebody please teach me? And they're like, what do you mean? Just feel it. I was like, I'm not feeling it, guys. I'm not feeling it. I'm scared. You know, dad, mom, won't you please slow down and teach me how to dance? You're like, dude, you just got to get out here and feel it. So I never learned. So I never learned. And my fiance is not particularly talented either. She has a lot of other great, you know, she has a lot of other redeeming qualities. She's my favorite person in the world, but neither one of us are particularly talented dancers. So the actual human movement of it, though, you know, it'll come up on my YouTube sometimes, and it's just totally captivated my imagination.
It is awesome.
Yeah, so just kind of seeing how awesome it is on YouTube, and then feeling like I'm getting older, frankly, and I just turned 30 this year, and it hit me hard, and kind of feeling determined not to shy away from those things that I'm scared of.
That's good.
And to instead look for it. Underneath the swing umbrella, there's Shag, Balboa, Lindy Hop. What else am I missing here? Jitterbug.
Charleston. East Coast is sort of a, you know, like a sister to Lindy Hop.
It's the six count.
It's kind of the same thing, but it's a six count version of it.
Okay.
So it all started with Lindy Hop. I mean, after Charleston.
I know I didn't like prepare you guys for this, but if you don't mind, can we talk a little bit about the theory of swing and sort of like what makes swing swing? Can you guys just quickly take me through each one of these styles and tell me what differentiates them from the others?
Yeah. You want to go first?
Well, the
I know count, it's a tough question. Not anyone can answer that question.
You do half the dances and I'll do the other.
It's hard to, I guess, without showing you. I could easily show you. Go ahead.
Okay. So Lindy Hop is very exuberant and takes a lot of energy and very fast street style, down and dirty, bouncing into the floor, a lot of connection, a little bit more complicated. That's where it all kind of started.
Is it more like athletic almost? Like,
very athletic.
Got it.
Yes. Great workout. So that's kind of where it all started in the Savoy Ballroom. And then to kind of make it more of an easier social dance for the rest of the world, they sort of created the six count version of it as the norm.
Got it,
so that's where kind of like when I say jitterbug, I think of the six count because I think of the, you know, most of America kind of embraced that because it was easier. Lindy Hop's a little bit more difficult.
Got it.
But it's kind of the same thing. So that's kind of how that started. And East Coast is, you know, very Lindy Hop is travels a little bit more. East Coast is a little bit more
closed.
Yeah, you're in one spot on the floor, kind of moving closely together.
Okay. Okay.
You don't travel as much. There's not as much movement traveling as Lindy Hop.
Got it. Got it.
Yeah, you had people in the, you know, you have those flappers in the 20s, right? Doing Charleston. You picture those, the girls with the fringe and they're doing Charleston. Mm-hmm. Their feet are switching and they're, right? And they're dancing by themselves. And then that dance catches on and people start doing that, but they start doing it together.
In closed position. They make a circle out of it.
And then,
That's how kind of
then it breaks apart. And that's how Lindy Hop is born. And people love Charleston, but the Lindy Hop is just, that's kind of like the main thing that everyone wants to do. Everyone wants to learn because it is so exciting. Like she said, I mean, and there's so many options to what can happen.
Yeah.
What can occur during the swing out, which is the basic move. There's so many different variations and stylings and there's so much freedom to play, which is one thing that Tina's so great at. Like people love dancing with her because you don't know what she's going to, she could do all this crazy stuff. It's pretty cool. And that's what makes it fun. Yeah,
it's super free.
So from a,
every dance could be different.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Not to get hung up on the theory of swing, but I've actually just had these questions for a while. Mm. So, you're typically following.
Mm-hmm.
So to what extent do you have to do you have like freedom to improvise and freedom to roam? Are you not obligated to see, I don't get that. Like to follow, like when do you get to go and improvise?
Whenever I can. So
the statistics show that by 2020, Most of the jobs are going to be automated. A lot of the jobs that people are doing now,
right?
Manufacturing and all these kind of things. So they need to step up their skills, or they need to get new skills. So, but for the newer, younger generation, we really want to push them into those fields now, so they'll be ready. They'll have the skills. And after talking to a bunch of teachers and talking to a bunch of other educators and people in the tech industry and manufacturing, they basically said that it starts in fourth grade, the third grade.
Oh my goodness. This
is where the math drops off. A lot of students are really good at math, and then when they start splitting the classes, that's when they drop off. And now you have
to start tracking students. Like, oh, maybe you're a little bit more talented. You go into algebra and geometry sooner. You stay in remedial math, and then you start tracking kids.
Exactly. And it's after that first test, and then now you fail the first test, right? So you're like, oh, man, I'm not good at math. I don't like
it. And that's in your head and you're a kid.
That's in your head. And then the thing is, there's a small difference between the students that are in, right? So, like, let's say 50% of the students are – you know, pass the test. Well, what about the other 50? Well, there's probably another 20-30% that are just right there. Just a little bit of tutoring could get them over the top. So that's the gap that we're trying to bridge, is to help those students kind of get over the top. But to do that, we can't just be like, okay, we're just going to do math. We have to show them why they should do math, like what's going to be exciting about that. And so the way that we're going to show that is just to show them, like, look, there's exciting jobs in STEM. There's exciting job in science, in manufacturing, you know, working at Tesla, working at Facebook. These are cool stuff. But to get there, you're going to need to probably either get a college degree, or you're going to have these technical skills that you have to be really advanced at. So if you do anything
in computer science, whether it be coding or advanced manufacturing.
Exactly. All these type of things, you're going to need to up your technical skills. But I think that if we kind of show them that there's a purpose to what they're doing, then they're going to be more excited to kind of take school seriously.
Got it. So when our mutual friend Rod sort of explained your endeavor to me, he indicated that you were teaming up with tech companies who are looking to build a workforce pipeline that is as diverse as it is talented.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, they have, I think, real diversity issues over in Silicon Valley, right?
Yes.
You know, probably not helped at all by a recent memo written by James Damore, right? Trying to say that there's actual biological differences between the sexes and what, you know, other sorts of nonsense, right? These are really, I think, unhealthy narratives to put in the minds of young children and to sort of propagate, right, throughout the ether. How do you team up with these high-tech companies to provide those opportunities for the students to sort of see what STEM is all about and to sort of see what they have to offer? He was saying that you all do these events.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
We're going to do, actually. And we're going to have an event coming up in 2 weeks. Actually, the first one is going to be in LA. But those events are for a little bit older students, the ones that are in high school.
Okay.
But the way we partner with the tech companies is that the good news is that there's a lot of tech workers that do care.
You know,
there's a lot of tech workers that understand that this is a problem. There's a lot of underrepresented groups. You know, I've been to Netflix. I've been to Facebook. There was another event in Oakland. The Kapoor Center is really big in the tech, and they really have a lot of programs. So just kind of piping into those groups and organizations. Another one that was really influential is I have to give her a shout out, is Ania Williams. She did a conference called Black and Brown Founders.
Okay.
And then she brought in a lot of basically people that are in that industry and kind of breaking down some things and kind of helping, you know, small business, you know, people like me to kind of get started, but at the same time, giving a lot of information about the tech industry. And then so through kind of, you know, some people that I met there, I was able to get into deeper networks with the tech companies, and they were like, yes, we have diversity programs, we have outreach programs, and just kind of tapping into those. We're able to kind of, you know, get some guest speakers and get some people to come and just really encourage students to kind of go in those fields, and also to kind of, you know, counter that narrative that you just talked about. You know, some people are actually working really hard to have more people come in and more diversity and more inclusion for women, give more opportunities for everybody else. So there's a lot of companies that do a good job.
I think folks will be more likely to seek out employment in those fields if they feel that it's a safe space for people like them, right? What is up? It is another episode of Sacktown Talks. As a reminder, stop looking for the host you want. Love the host you've got. That's me. I'm Jabron Maciel. We're here with Richard Munoz.
How you doing?
How you doing?
I'm doing good.
Dude, I'm so glad we could connect.
Me too. Thanks for having me. I'm glad your first guest got sick.
Yeah. Just to kind of let everyone know, I feel like this is picking up in a positive direction, because we just kind of chatted over Facebook because you had seen the...
I'd seen what you'd broadcast so far, what you're putting out there, and I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
You're doing a good job.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that. And I started looking at some of your work, and I was like, wow, that's some pretty compelling stuff.
You think so?
Yeah. I think it's beautiful.
Good.
I actually minored in art history.
Did you really?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're like a Renaissance man.
Sure, why not?
My favorite thing's to make the host uncomfortable, then it's cool.
Oh my goodness.
No, that's cool though.
Wait, you know what? Let me make sure that the audio here is going the right way. It is. All right, good. We are good. So I was in a fraternity in college.
Okay.
And you know, when you're kind of getting indoctrinated into the fraternity system, you get like a big brother who's sort of like a mentor, you know?
Okay.
And he's like, well, you know, if you know you want to meet girls, take an art history class.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. He's like, take a nursing class or a communications class or art history. I said, I don't know, like maybe this art history stuff is kind of cool. So I took an art history class and it was like full of girls.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't talk to a single one because the art was so damn compelling.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's cool. I mean, your motivation wasn't right, but you got
My motivation was not right.
Well, but did it help in the long run?
It helped. You know what? It did help in the long
run. No, I mean with the chicks, not with the art. That's a yes.
Yeah. You know what? Art history should be, you know, in the UC system, it's sort of an elective.
Mm-hmm.
You can take a history course.
Sure.
World history course. And if you want to do an art history course, that can be one of the world, you know, but there's no specific requirement to do an art history course.
Yeah.
And I really think that there should be, because what a tremendous way to relate to people.
Exactly. You know? And it breaks any boundary with language or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, you can be from completely different places and relate to a piece and find that bond, that link.
Yeah, absolutely. My buddy Ashwin and I kind of had a random like highfalutin conversation around these similar lines.
Yeah.
And
that's cool.
Yeah. I was kind of talking to him and I was like, so have you heard such and such piece of music? You know, mm-hmm. He's like, I only listen to electronic dance music. I only listen to EDM.
Okay.
And I was like,
have asked. Huh.
Right. But you know, he says to me, you know, I believe that all moods can be encapsulated through like, beep, 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 you know, through sound.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I tripped out for a second. I thought to myself, well,
I've never heard music like that when I was at a funeral or a wake or anything, but I guess you could incorporate it.
Well,
you
through like sound alone and like no vocals, right?
Yeah.
And so
be a little trippy.
It caused me to question, does a certain sound resonate into a certain feeling in the same way? Does sound have feeling in the same way that like the color red has feeling independent of?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Because with me, when I'm painting, I look at the colors that I'm working with as notes, literally. Oh, wow. As notes. So if I want it to raise and lower, you know, I'll, you know, whether it's a secondary color or primary color, that's going to be more punch. You know what I mean? So I look at it like that. Music's the same way, I think.
Yeah.
Don't you?
I think so
too. Like you can hear one tone and it can put you in a mood. You can see one color. It can put you in a mood.
Yeah. I just think for me, it's an open question. I think like red does have meaning independent of language, and it has like primordial meaning almost.
Absolutely.
So you take a $75,000 pay cut with two daytime Emmy actors, daytime soap actors, daytime. Right?
And
how did you start lobbying folks in town? How's that work?
Well, you know, I really leveraged my interpersonal connections, you know.
Got it.
You know, living here my whole life and then obviously working in and around politics for that decade, you really get to meet a lot of people. And through that, business opportunities sort of arise. You know, I knew that one of the things that I really wanted to prioritize was nonprofit work. So I engaged myself with a number of local boards to meet people that way. I say that I shook every single hand I could for that first year and bought everybody a vodka soda, even when I couldn't afford it, just because.
On the credit card.
Yeah, of course.
No, that goodwill goes a long way.
It does. Right? Goodwill really does go a long way. And, you know, by the end of PHPR's first year, we were up to about 7 clients. And halfway through our year 2, I had recouped the salary that I had lost. And so, you know, I was really fortunate in that it was a risk that paid off.
Yeah. Insofar as going out on your own, What were the challenges that you kind of expected? It sounds like you maybe talked about that. What was the unexpected difficulties that sort of reared their heads where you're like, oh man, I wasn't ready for that?
Yeah.
Or was it smooth sailing?
It really wasn't smooth sailing. I mean, the actual work I was really confident in. I mean, I knew how to message. Right. I was confident, again, in my media contacts. So I knew I could guarantee the coverage placement that I was offering my clients. But, you know, what I had no idea how to do was run a business. I had no idea.
A little bit of everything, a little accounting, a little this, a little that. Yeah.
Tax IDs and budgeting and writing off things. And, you know, certainly as the business grew and we took on some employees and some contractors.
Now you're a manager too.
Right.
Now you're the human resources department. Sort of learning those
types of issues. And just for your own personal sake, planning your own health insurance and planning your own retirement and planning, you know, things that you just sort of take for granted when your employer handles it. I mean, that was a huge learning curve for me just because I'd never been in that situation before. And two, time management. I had a really hard time sort of managing my time with regards to personal, professional life, you know, and that was sort of draining because, you know, when it's just you, it's your own hustle.
Right, right. And and in that, in terms of time management and balancing your workload with your social calendar, there's a go between, there's a bleed there, right?
Oh, like
if you go into the bunker and just do your work, then your contacts start going stale.
You're not shaking hands.
You're not buying
vodka sodas.
Yeah.
Right.
So you're just grinding 24/7.
And, you know, I really do look at, one of the things that I learned about myself at a young age was that I'm really social and I love being out. I love meeting new people. And so that was one of the things I thought that really kind of complemented owning my own business was that I was going to be at these events anyway, because I like to be at them, you know, and particularly if it's a good cause or a fun crowd, I mean, gosh, sign me up. So now that I can kind of use these events to further the agency visibility, it's a win-win.
That's awesome. Do you have any advice for any young professionals looking to go out on their own in whatever their discipline is, or even as far as PR?
Yeah, you know, I do. I speak a lot of times to colleges, you know, graduating classes, people that have really studied PR and are really excited to get out into the world. I think that you can't ever underestimate big agency or, again, big statewide association experience. I mean, I do think that there's a learning curve. I think that a lot of times people are really, you know, and this is one of the things I love the most about millennials, but they're so driven to kind of do everything right out of the gate. I think that there is truly something to be said for really honing your craft and getting that experience first. But the other thing that I would always tell people is to really know your lane. I mean, I've sort of devised PHPR to be hyper-local. You know, we've got a couple statewide.
You know, you remind me of, I had Andy Young on.
Oh, I love Andy.
And he, yeah.
Andy, I work with Andy. Andy's the man. A couple clients.
Yeah, he did this logo. It's my favorite logo.
So good.
I was over at a mutual friend's wedding, actually my brother-in-law's wedding. And so we saw him. I'd love to catch up with the guy. But, you know, he said something interesting where, like, he says, like, the value proposition is that I am local. I understand Sacramento trends, Sacramento culture, and I'm kind of an influencer within this sphere.
It's 100% accurate.
Yeah.
That's how I view PHPR as well. I mean, look, we're not going to compete with an Ogilvy or an Edelman. We just don't, frankly, have the budget or the staff resources. So why bother? You know, but what you're going to get from me if you're a local restaurateur or a local nonprofit is going to be a much bigger bang for your buck because of my local connections.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Just, you know, going to Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, what was that like? You know, if that's not too intrusive to ask.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about it. So my dad, I'm of Russian descent. We came here when I was a little kid, and my dad served in the Russian military. He was in Spetsnaz, and so when I came here,
so you're all badasses.
I sure, you know, never want to toot your own horn, but thank you. I'll take it.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, my dad was in Spetsnaz, and he did some pretty gnarly stuff in the military. And so when we immigrated to America, America opened up the doors to us, and very, very fortunate now and then to have the opportunity to come here. And the great thing about being in America, being an American, is the fact that here, if you work hard and you set your mind or you set a goal to accomplish something, it's feasible, it's doable, as long as you get your education and you know, you do the right things. We came here with nothing, you know. My dad came here with all our, you know, we have six kids in the family, big family, and started with nothing, and we're very successful now, or at least I'd like to think that, and very fortunate to be here. So when I joined the military, I joined as just regular infantry, you know, nothing special, just regular infantry. I figured I got to do it either now or never. So I joined, and then in basic training, I stood out. I was the crazy Russian guy, the communist or whatever, you know. It was just an ongoing kind of a joke.
Yeah. Well, you're also super fit though, right?
Yeah.
So you're that's an enviable asset to have in that profession.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. I've always been in great shape. My dad has always, you know, kind of pushed me to work out and stay in shape, and yeah, it's a kind of a lifestyle, you know.
Right.
So I kick butt in basic. I, you know, soldier of the cycle or honor grad or PT award, all those things I was able to be awarded. And to me, it was easy because it was just another day. You know, it wasn't anything crazy or out of the norm. At least for me, it wasn't. And then I got offered an airborne position. And after airborne, I got offered the ranger position. I was like, sweet, this is cool. I'll do it. And so went through RIP. It was RIP at that point, which is Ranger Indoctrination Program. Did well there, and then I got assigned to Fort Lewis, Washington, which is 2nd Ranger Battalion. There's 3 battalions, and 2nd is out of Fort Lewis. And so yeah, I did my 3 tours. While in, I had a, you know, like I mentioned, there's always ups and downs. Great time. Actually, for me, I was fortunate. Things fell into place. I came into the military at the same time when I don't know if you know, have you heard of Pat Tillman?
Yeah.
A football player.
Absolutely.
So he was out of 2nd Ranger Battalion, and they made contact, and that the incident happened right when I was coming into battalion. So it was a big, big thing that was going on at that time. And, so besides that incident, you know, there were a lot of situations within the military that a lot of people don't understand. You know, when you're overseas and your rules of engagement are set to, there's limits and things that you can and can't do, like anywhere else.
They're very defensive, aren't they? Right? Don't shoot till shot at, stuff like that.
So, I don't know how it is now, but we, as Americans, we try to make sure that everybody goes home safe, right? And so there are different situations that do come up, and the hard part is when you're over there and you're you know, you make contact, and you know, there's firefights and that sort of things, those sort of things happen. You don't really, I guess, realize the extent of what's going on or how it's going to affect you or your buddies or anything that's going on there until you get back home. Until you go to a ceremony and, you know, you see your buddy in a coffin or anything like that, you know, that's when it kind of, you know, hits you and you're like, whoa, you know, what's going on? And, so I don't really like to talk too much about it, but
fair.
Yeah, that's just kind of, it's an eye opening, you know, and then you see their, you know, your buddy's girlfriend or wife, and just volunteers. You can't do anything about it, you know. So it's tough, you know. And so,
you know, that we're supposed to have in our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, and so you found your way to the gym, and you know, I'm glad that, you know, we were training partners for a little while, and I always admired you because of your commitment to fitness, how quickly you picked things up, you know. And then shortly after we met, you started taking fights, right?
Yeah.
Are you, how many fights have you had?
So six professional fights.
Wow. At, will you fight 170 pounds?
170, yeah, right. Welterweight.
Right? Wow. Mm-hmm. Is that a big cut for you, by the way?
It is. It's tough for me because I'm naturally pretty lean. Guys that, you know, been in the gym with me, they know I'm, pretty lean normally, and so cutting down, I'm probably right now walking around at mid 80s, 88, 85, 88, something like that. So cutting down
to, and not a lot of fat on you to get rid of.
Not much, no. So it's a lot of water weight. So I'm, you know, I'm very dehydrated in when I'm making weight. So it's tough. It's very tough.
Yeah. What was that first, what was that first profile like for you?
The first one was, you know, the first couple ones were pretty quick. They ended pretty quick. I think a lot of the guys were a little intimidated by, my appearance and this crazy Russian guy coming out and fighting, you know? But it was, again, I don't want to abuse the word, but it's therapeutic for me, you know, like you talked about getting dirty and sweating and hanging out with guys and just working, getting pushed and pushing yourself to the limit. That is very good for a lot of people, veterans and non-veterans. And so, violence is needed, not, and like you mentioned, controlled violence. You're doing things, in a way, in a, you're,
well, you know, people often ask, like, well, how does that whole thing happen? Like, how do people become homeless? I mean, well, like, there's no one thing. It's not like something that someone did. They didn't aspire to be homeless. They didn't, you know, a lot of times, you know, you got a number of folks out there who are one paycheck away from being homeless.
You know, I read something. I'm going to stop you right here. I read something, you know, and for my guests out there, for my folks out there listening, guys, this podcast is a lot more work than you think it is. However much work you think putting this podcast together, multiply that by like three or five. And that's about how much work it is. But it's actually really rewarding, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when I was researching you a little bit to sort of, you know, not be a knucklehead on the show myself, yeah, right, to sort of know what to ask you, I stumbled upon Sacramento Homeless Blog, mm-hmm, you know, the guy who wrote it was actually very hopeful about your tenure, mm-hmm, you know, but he had this line at the end. It's kind of vague, but it said, you know, every homeless person in Sacramento has a doppelganger, mm-hmm, in, you know, in regular society. Mm-hmm. And to me, that meant kind of what you said is like, for every, you know, member of, you know, regular society, every member of the not homeless population, right?
Yeah.
There is a person who's, you know, whose soul and whose dignity is just as beautiful out there, who's going through something that perhaps the not homeless person just hasn't gone through and may never have to go through in their life. But,
yeah,
you know, whether it be, you know, economic instability and you're just one paycheck away from homelessness, whether it be severe mental health trauma that you're just unable to recover from, whether it be, you know, putting the wrong substance, you know, having a friend put the wrong substance in front of you and then boom, you're hooked. You know, it can often feel like we're worlds away from the homeless population, because, you know, we do our very best not to see them, mm-hmm, right? We do our very best to kind of continually shoo them off to the corners of Midtown and the downtown area, so that we don't have to sort of deal with them in our day to day basis. But they're just like us. I'll bet you, if you start really looking at those life stories, there are some real similarities to every other member of society. I'll just expand on this one just a little bit more, if you allow me to. My father said to me, you know, we're immigrants from Mexico, and my dad came to the United States in his mid 20s, right? And he would always sort of offer reflections on how the two countries were similar and different, you mm-hmm know. And actually, frankly, his most enduring gift to me is the fact that he sort of talked to me as if I were an adult when I was a child, and mm-hmm sort of allowed me to expand my mind, I think, right? But mm-hmm he said to me one thing that I didn't really make sense of until years later. And he said to me, the difference between, or one of the differences between the U.S. and Mexico is that in the U.S., poverty is absolute. Mm-hmm. By which, you know, and he just kind of left it at that. And I didn't really understand what he meant. But as I've sort of reflected on that statement, you know, in my adulthood, I think what he meant is that, what he means by saying poverty is absolute in the U.S., it's that there's poverty of dignity. There's poverty of, you know, poverty is also layered with like a sense of like social isolation, mm-hmm, right? And poverty is also layered with criminality, mm-hmm, right? in Mexico, there's, I think there's just a lot more of a sense of like, wow, that could really be me, you know? And there's not a sort of lack of dignity necessarily that goes with, you know, there's always a lack of dignity, but not as severe or and pervasive and persistent as there is here, because everyone else is doing, is, you know, so much better off. Right. And not to, not
that's
to totally,
that's the perception.
Yeah. That's the perception. Yeah.
No, and I think that, you know what, when, I mean, we're all a lot closer to it than anyone really wants to admit. And we, I think we do, I mean, this, so my mental health counselor, my mental health counselor background coming into play, when we look at, you know, how we as a society look at homelessness, I mean, it's always one of these things like, oh, that'll never happen to me. You know, they did something, they, you know, they were asking for it. Yeah. Something happened and it was all their fault that now they're homeless. So like, don't, you know, come over here and distance yourself from them. And, but I think the reality is, and that I think that people secretly know is that they're a lot closer to it than they want to admit. But oftentimes people try to keep it at arm's length, and keep themselves as far away from even thinking that, because just that thought of like, whoa, that could be me. Like that's pretty sobering to folks when they think about that.